So, Darlene, are you okay that we record your presentation?
Oh, yes. As long as I get a copy, please.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Yes, he's in California. Darlene, what city are you in?
What?
What city are you in?
I can't hear you.
What city are you in?
This is Santa Monica.
It's so beautiful.
Blocks in here.
Oh, wow. It's so beautiful.
Yeah, I took this picture from the Ferris wheel.
Oh, how cool.
Hi.
Well, we're ready to start when you are. We're ready to start when you are.
Is there an introduction or should I just start talking?
Well, I would love to introduce you. I felt really excited about having Darlene because she's one of the most well-known codependent writers, and we feel very lucky to have her with us today to be able to just tell us about her story and all she wants to talk about on codependency. Thank you for joining us. We feel very happy to have you.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I wish I could see the audience though, instead of the screen. I wanted to be able to see the audience.
Hi, can you see us?
I can. Okay. So I'll just start with my own story a little bit. And my codependency started when I was born. Now we know it's transgenerational, but I had a narcissistic mother. So probably you can infer a lot from that. She wanted to mold me into her ideal self. And I was very compliant. She told me I was adaptable. So it was my personality to be accommodating to begin with. And then I learned pretty early on that it wasn't going to be well received if I disagreed, if I spoke up too much, if I said no to things. In fact, my mother told me that I never went through the terrible twos and I was a perfect baby. And I suppose it's because of the dysfunctional parenting I got right in the crib. So I learned very early how to please her and to get my needs met that way. And what goes along with having a narcissistic parent is that it's their way or the highway. And there's often a lot of criticism and scolding, not just a narcissist, but an addict or just a dysfunctional family. And I got my share of that. My feelings were shame. Anger wasn't allowed. Wasn't allowed to talk back. I remember one time I was having fear and my mother laughed at that. And that was silly to feel that. If I was crying over some girlfriend or boyfriend, she would say I should be angry. And but of course, anger wasn't allowed. So my feelings were pretty much shame. As well as my needs, I was shamed for wanting attention, which all kids want, shamed for needing love, needing support, wanting sex. All those things were considered not something that a woman wants or inappropriate, or actually sometimes just having them ignored. If your feelings are ignored, that's another form of shaming. You don't have to be called out for it or put down for it, just if they're not met in some way. So All my life, I carried deep shame and pain about not having a close relationship with my mother, because for all this, I didn't like her. And I thought there was something wrong with me, because of course, children are supposed to love their mothers. We learned that on television. And I didn't like her, and I felt like I didn't love her. And so in fact, I remember I was about 9 years old, and my brother took me to see the movie Queen Bee with Joan Crawford. And it was about a narcissistic, abusive mother who wanted to be very glamorous in the center of attention. And she got in between her sons and her sons, her daughter-in-law. And this was something that I was observing at home. And I thought, oh my God, this movie explains what's going on. And I didn't talk to anybody about it. And in my child's mind, I equated Joan Crawford with my mother. Of course, Joan Crawford was an exaggeration. I wasn't experiencing anything like that at home. But, you know, to a little girl, suddenly things fell into place and made sense. And it was around that time where my mother would sometimes take me to school or pick me up, and I didn't want to kiss her. She'd want me to kiss her. And I pulled away, and she said, oh, you're too old now to kiss your mother. So I think I decided I hated her at that point. And it was really sad, because she wanted me to love her, of course, and I wanted her to love me. But unfortunately, it was never the twain to meet. And we both were feeling a lot of pain in this relationship, even though we both wanted love from each other. And she thought that she was being helpful by correcting me or making me feel guilty. One time I said to her, you're just making me feel guilty. She said, well, you should feel guilty. So I learned when I was older, when she would criticize me, I would say, well, I guess I'm just not the daughter that you wanted. You know, I'll never measure up to be a good enough daughter. That kind of shut her up, because I was agreeing with her. So she had nowhere to go with that. But meanwhile, I suffered from this low self-esteem. But of course, a little girl doesn't know what that is. And I remember playing in the sandbox in first grade. And there was a little girl there that was 10. And I thought, wow, when I have two digits in my age, then I'll be happy. I always wanted to be older, because I thought that being older, I would have more freedom and somehow I would feel better. And looking back, I know that I suffered from low self-esteem. I figured my kids didn't like me. I might have one or two good friends. I'd be jealous if they were friends with somebody else. I'd think, well, maybe they like them better. In school, I was always running for office and always losing. So I figured nobody likes me. And I was kind of standoffish. And so people maybe took that to mean that I thought I was better than them, but actually I felt like I was not good enough to be liked. And my mother used to want to dress me up in back in the day, these Lance dresses, and they were expensive, nice dresses for young girls. But I wanted to wear what the other girls were wearing. So I just wanted to wear these baggy shirts, you know, tennis shoes, and not only that, I was allergic to wool, but nobody knew it. And I would be itching like crazy in these dresses. And my mother would just say, you're just too sensitive. So like there's something wrong with me. It wasn't until much, much later as an adult, I took some allergy tests and found out that I was allergic to wool. So very funny. And I didn't know why, but I always like to sit at the front of the class. And in a movie, I want to sit by the aisle. And I didn't figure it out till much later that I felt like claustrophobic. I wanted to have space. And I think it's because my mother was so controlling and invasive. I couldn't like lock the door or anything. And so I needed some distance. In fact, I think when I was in junior high, they asked us in school, what would we do if we had $1 million? And my wish was to buy an island so I could run away to. So obviously I didn't think relationships were safe. And it was actually not until I joined 12-step meetings, my first was Al-Anon, that I learned to have relationships with other women and really value that. I would have a girlfriend, a close girlfriend, but generally I think I was afraid of women because of my relationship with my mother. And I made wonderful friendships in 12-step programs. And it was a big part of my healing was the after meeting and going out to coffee. And I'll tell more about that later. But so basically I didn't have any idea of who I was. Except that whoever I was somehow not okay. And I remember in high school, the teacher asked me to be a volunteer myself to participate in a research project. And I guess it was a therapist that was interviewing people. And I went into a room and she turned on the tape recorder and she didn't tell me any instructions. So I didn't really know like what I was supposed to do. So I just started, after a while, just sitting there bored, I started talking to her about my siblings and my parents, and I didn't say anything about myself. And I look back on that many years later, I think I recount that story in one of my books, that it was really a symptom. I really didn't know who I was. And when I first got into 12-step meetings, when I first went to Al-Anon, I was married to an abusive, borderline personality alcoholic. And when I finally, I never knew if I was gonna stay. And I resented having to go there to begin with because I thought there was nothing wrong with me. He had the problem. But I, for the maybe the first year, I would talk to my sponsor and I would report on him and how he was doing with his drinking or not drinking or whatever. And she was very patient. She would say, "That's fine, darling." You know, she never criticized me or anything. I guess that's as much as I could do at that stage. And I remember when I had a sponsor in Al-Anon, and one time she said to me that she loved me. And I was like flabbergasted. And I thought, how could that be? Because she's just helping me. I'm not doing anything to help her. And so why would she love me? Because the idea was that I wasn't worthy of being loved for who I was, only for what I did or what I could give. So being a rescuer came naturally to me. There was a boy in high school that I had heard accidentally shot his friend. A gun went off or something. And his parents like ostracized him. And it was like a big trauma in his life. And I felt so sorry for him. And I just fell in love with him. He was the one I wanted. Of course, he was unavailable and wasn't interested in me, but he was someone that I had my eye on. And then finally, when I did meet my husband, he told me the sad story about his experiences as a Holocaust survivor and all of his trauma that he went through. And my heart went out to him. So I call it like love at first blight, because my empathy was there and I confuse empathy with love. And it never occurred to me that I needed love, that I needed love back. It was all about giving love and finding somebody who I could love and give love to them and not think about whether my needs were getting met. I know when I was a kid, I would go to my mother and I would say, you know, what is this little spot on my hand or a freckle or something? And she would just dismiss me and maybe say that I needed attention or it was nothing. And looking back, it was some way of getting kind of love or attention from her. And she would read me Little Women stories when I was in grade school. And I remember enjoying sitting on her lap when she loved to read, and she'd read me this story, The Little Women. And one day I said, oh, but that's not what, you skipped what Amy said over there. And she was furious. And I corrected her. And she slammed the book and she said, oh, you can read. Well, just go read it yourself. And not only was I shocked and sad about the whole thing, it's like now I wasn't going to have this time with her, this closeness where she, this was about as close to nurturing as it ever got, to be able to sit on her lap and she'd read me these stories. And then to make matters worse, the next day at school, she went to school and had a tirade and bawled out the principal and my teacher because I wasn't reading enough as she thought that I should. And I was so humiliated and embarrassed. But my teacher seemed to know me better than my mother because she introduced me to a series of adventure stories. And I read them, the whole series. They were Enid Blyton at the time. They're out of print now, but I just loved them. They were adventure stories. And then I read that series. And then I went on to Nancy Drew. And that was more to my liking. I never ended up reading Little Women. I couldn't care less about them. So I was all for adventure. And my mother never really knew who I was, didn't understand me. And as I said, she tried to mold me into being a lady. I remember when I was 16, she gave me Emily Post's etiquette book. I was just so angry, I never opened that book. So that's who she thought I should be. And my father wasn't any help. And I was so disillusioned with him because he never protected me. In fact, he never even stood up for himself when she would be critical or, in my mind, bossy or shaming him. And so he fell off his pedestal very, very early. And I vowed to myself, I would always look for a strong man, that I'd never wanted to be with someone I considered weak. For one reason, I thought that I might turn into my mother. So I better marry a strong man who would keep me in line. And I did. So my husband, when I met him, he could call my mother a bitch. And I thought, this is good. He'll protect me. He'll stand up for me. He does. He's not afraid of her. And little did I know, before long, he'd be calling me a bitch. So I mistook strength. I got confused between strength and anger. And I thought his bullying and his angry demeanor signified strength. Little did I know how weak he was. And actually, I was the stronger one in the relationship, but it took a long time for me to realize that. And also, if a man wanted to please me, I equated that to weakness, which is really sad because then I was never getting my needs met. I was always trying to please them and sacrifice to make them happy. I thought that would be my role. I didn't want to be like my mother, who I thought was too bossy and controlling. So that set me up for a disappointing relationship, some of these beliefs I had. And when we talk about overcoming the codependent mind, it's all based on lies and these false ideas that we get from childhood. It all starts with shame is really the core of codependency. And some of the beliefs that we infer as children, for instance, that, you know, anger equals strength, or kindness is people pleasing, or that if I was someone who pleases me, I'll turn into my mother, things like that. Or I was afraid to have children, that I would be a mother like my own mother. So we have these beliefs that we have to challenge. Unfortunately, pretty much we're unconscious of them until they are pointed out to us. That's why therapy is helpful. Or a lot of times our behavior belies our beliefs. So a lot of times codependents think if they're not in a relationship, they're ashamed of that, rather than it's fine not to be in a relationship, or that someone has to love me for me to be lovable. So then I have to prove that I win somebody's love. Because if they just love me, then they probably don't have good taste, or they want something from me, or their standards are too low, something like that. Because we have to love ourselves to be able to receive love. And so challenging all these beliefs that we don't have to earn love, we don't have to win love, that we're lovable just for who we are, that we're innocent. And by the way, shame breeds a lot of guilt and fear and anxiety. So we have anxiety that we're going to be found out, that we're going to make a mistake, that we're going to be left, that we're going to be rejected or judged, and fear of emotional abandonment, if that's what we grew up with. And if you have a parent who doesn't love you for who you are, that's emotional abandonment right there, because then it's just conditional love. It's only how well you perform to their expectations. One day, I think it was in the 90s, I realized how foolish it was to try to win somebody's approval, because they will give or withhold their approval based on who they are and their ideals and their values and their tastes, which have nothing to do with me. And that was during a time when I decided to change professions, because my first career, you might know, was as a lawyer, was really to win my mother's respect, because she wanted my brother, so she thought he'd be a good lawyer. So I thought, well, I'll finally get her respect. And when I did become a lawyer, she always said, yeah, I don't know why you went into law. Your brother would have been a great lawyer. So, you know, in the end, I never got it. I was trying to win her respect, which I didn't get from that. So during my marriage, it just reinforced my low self-esteem, because my husband was very controlling. He had mood swings all the time. I didn't understand. From his personality disorder and from his drinking, I was always on edge. And we used to do this dance called the Cartman Triangle. I don't know if you've heard of that, where I would try to, he would come to me for help. And then I would try to be the helpful spouse and try to give him advice or something like that. And then he would always say, yes, but, and it was never what he wanted to hear, because what he really wanted was attention and love. Instead, he was asking for advice. And then he would turn on me. It might lead to violence. So I was in an abusive relationship. And I'm happy that today there's so much more knowledge out there, and with more meetings and the internet, and there's just so much more information about things that were never talked about. Back in the day, I started Al-Anon in 1979, and nobody discussed violence, nobody discussed intimacy, PTSD, trauma, all these words that are just common lingo now that people talk about were never discussed. So I feel like people are changing and healing much more quickly, because and that's why I'm so grateful to share, because we could pass on what we learn. And then I was in, as I said, when I first went to program, I resented it and I didn't know why I was there. Somebody said to me at a meeting, they said, you know, it takes two to fight. And I kept that in my mind. And when I went home and I started ignoring my husband and not getting into arguments with him. So just, you know, I could drop the ball, because if you don't throw the ball back, then you're not in a conflict. So that was a beginning tidbit that I learned. But I didn't like the whole God concept. I was an atheist, and it took me a long time to accept that. And my sponsor said, well, why don't you just talk about it at meetings? Because I was getting angry when people were saying, God found me a parking space and he saved my home from foreclosure and all these things. And it didn't make any sense to me. So I did. And you know what? They didn't kick me out of the meeting. So little by little, I learned that what a higher power was. And I started looking for synchronicity. And I started having faith. And that was huge for me. It made a big difference, because letting go was so hard, because I felt like I'm on the edge of a cliff, clinging by my fingernails. You know, I'm hanging down from the cliff and I'm afraid to let go. And then one day I just realized it's like I could fall, I could let go and fall into a cloud. And I wasn't going to get hurt. And what made the difference between holding on and letting go was faith. And so I was able to just kind of go with the flow more. I remember my husband my family was inviting me to something, and I knew it was going to be a big conflict with my husband. And my sponsor would say, well, do you have to decide today? And I said, no. So she'd say that to me like every week. And every week I'd say, well, I don't really have to let them know today. And then the whole thing was canceled like a couple months later. So it never even came to pass. But in my marriage, it was like the Barry Manilow song. Like if he was in a good mood, I was in a good mood. If he was in a bad mood, I was afraid, you know, it was terrible. And sometimes it's like that with a borderline personality. It's like when they're in a good mood, there's no one who is more fun. And when they're in a bad mood, there's the last person you want to be around. And it was very much like a parent-child relationship. And he would ask me questions, and I thought I had an answer. And I thought I had to tell him everything. And then I would get like scolded or condemned for it. And eventually, he went to AA, and the person who got him there suggests I go to Al-Anon. And I started thinking that I had some rights and to not accept unacceptable behavior, and started getting in touch with my feelings a little bit, started working the steps. But I think it took me 3 years to actually let go a little bit and detach because I know this because we went on a family vacation and we got there and he decided to leave, which wasn't so unusual actually. I always had to have a plan B because he was so unreliable and unpredictable. So I stayed, I was with my children, and I was in a beautiful spot. And I remember enjoying the nature, and we were by a stream, and it was so peaceful and beautiful. And I realized I wasn't worried and thinking about him. And that was the first time that I realized that. Before that, I would go on serenity retreats, and I would call to make sure everything was okay and we had food. And my husband was my higher power. So that started to change after about the third year. And then it took me even 6 years to start working the steps, not for the relationship, but for myself, to really focus on myself and know that I had to change, not just to make this relationship work. And then I started, maybe you've heard of Ernie Larson, and he was a pillar in the codependency therapeutic community. And I bought a series of his tapes, and I started holding meetings in my home, and we would listen to the tapes and we would discuss them. And then somehow or other, I found my way to an assertiveness class at a local college. And I came home and I started being assertive. And I said, don't talk to me that way. And what you said is humiliating, and stop it. And my husband was like, couldn't believe it. His jaw dropped. But you know what? Things started getting better. I had to be consistent, and he stopped calling me names, stopped being so abusive. It actually was working. And then the best part of the program was working. I had amazing encounters with people. It gave me a lot of joy, and except when I made amends to my mother, because she added things to the list that I had overlooked. And so I started having boundaries, because before that, there were no boundaries with my mother. I absorbed all the abuse that my husband was giving me. It was like I was a sponge. So whatever he said, I assumed it was true. And he would say to me, I have more class than you have. I have more class in my little finger, he would say, than you have. And I would just feel so ashamed. Of course, he was the one that didn't have any class. So eventually I left that marriage. And in the end, I was afraid to leave because I was afraid of more abuse. But that didn't happen because the power structure had changed so much in the relationship that he wanted. Yeah, I had made my decision to leave the same day that he asked for a divorce. It was synchronicity. We both came to that decision the same day. But I was so happy, but I had to just grit my teeth and just say, okay, if that's what you want, because I didn't want to shame him and say, great. You know, I was feeling so excited because I had was thinking about this for some time. And I had to go through a lot of grief. But I had already realized, I was sitting in a meeting and I realized when I leave, it'll be because I'm happy, not because I'm so sad. And that's what happened because I realized I had to have a life to go to. And now he was kind of superfluous because I had friends, I had activities and hobbies, I had reclaimed myself. And he wasn't necessary for me anymore. He still needed me, and he was the one that was feeling abandoned, but I was ready to leave. And I just, my whole life opened up after that. I changed my careers at the same time, and I was teaching and I was writing and I was traveling and I was dancing, which I always wanted to do, and making friends. So everything was opening. It was one of the happiest times of my life. But as I said, I didn't know that I was a battered wife. I didn't know that I had PTSD. And all this was, I thought I had left that relationship and that was over. That chapter was closed. And on the outside, it looked that way. But I was still afraid to really get into a relationship. I still didn't know what real intimacy was. I didn't know that I carried shame. It came to me in a dream that there was a woman in bed with me named Shame, and I had to get to know her. I didn't know who she was. So I was used to talking about myself in meetings and sharing these things, but not with the general public. And I went to a workshop in Northern California at a place called Esalen. I don't know if you've heard of it. And there was it came out in the workshop somehow that I was sharing that I was had been married to an alcoholic. And I felt so embarrassed saying this. And then there was another workshop I went to and I volunteered to be like the guinea pig in the center of the circle. And I don't remember what I was talking about, but I guess it was emotional for me. And I said to the facilitator, I said, I need a hug. And she said, well, you're going to have to ask for it. And I was like tongue-tied. I couldn't believe, you know, that I was actually going to have to ask for her to hug me. And I didn't know that at the time, but looking back, I realized that my need for nurturing and love had been shame, because that felt humiliating to me. And even later, there was a boyfriend I had, and I wanted him to spend more time with me. And I was practically choking on my words to ask for that. So the things changed. What I had was a romance addiction. And it was very hard to let go of because I would go on these highs with someone and we were in love, but it wouldn't last. And I always thought that I'm just choosing the wrong men. Why am I having such bad luck? And eventually I had to realize that I had to feel worthy of receiving. So I had told you that story about my sponsor who said, I love you. And I couldn't understand that. And so I really had to feel that I was worthy of love to be able to receive it because we attract how we feel inside. And there was a lot of grief, like in letting go of this and changing. And when these relationships would end, it would be so hard for me to recover. I could like be thinking about the guy for 2 years and sad or holding a candle for him. And what I came to know is it was really about my mother. It was the love that I never really got, felt that I had in that relationship. So every abandonment was a reenactment of that, you could call it PTSD or that trauma from my childhood. And so I didn't realize that I had trauma. And not only from my childhood, but from my marriage, was probably worse from my marriage. But sometimes I think it's worse in our adult relationships because it takes that much more pain to feel how you feel as a four-year-old, a five-year-old, when you're so vulnerable and you're so open. It wasn't until my mother, actually a day or two before she died, that I had this image that really was said it all. My mother used to, when I feel like we're suddenly finally having a good mother-daughter relationship and I felt some closeness, she'd give me a zinger and she'd give me some sort of criticism or comment or something like that. So, and it happened just a few days before she died. And then I had this image of her being a tennis ball machine. And I realized that I could like lob the ball, I could smash the ball, I could go over to that tennis ball machine and break my racket on it. But it was just gonna keep sending me these zingers. It was gonna just keep throwing the ball no matter what I did. And there was nothing I could do to change that relationship, but that's who she was. And but in my mind, I later realized that if I had anger or resentment towards her, that I was holding that hatred or I was holding that anger. And then I had to forgive her because otherwise I couldn't really forgive myself. That I couldn't hold hatred and anger towards someone without having that within me. Because of course I'm the one that was feeling it. So I did come to understand her and forgive her. She suffered a lot in her childhood and was doing the best that she could. She didn't neglect me, except emotionally. So eventually my worth was no longer dependent on being loved or having a certain career. It was something inside of me that I had to develop an intimate relationship with myself to be able to have that with others, so that I felt free to speak my truth and be honest, not be afraid they're gonna leave. If it doesn't work out, then it's not the relationship for me. So I have to be able to be myself in all my relationships and honor my needs and honor my feelings and meet them. So that's really difficult. You know, I have a blog where I talk about meeting your, the key to happiness is meeting your needs. And it's pretty simple. It's like, meet your needs and you feel good, and don't meet your needs and you feel bad. And it's hard enough to get over denial of feelings and learn how we're feeling. But for most codependents, it's really hard to identify our emotional needs. Sometimes in my case, my material needs were met, but emotional needs were, I was clueless about them. So I had to, in fact, if I was lonely, I would isolate. So that doesn't make any sense. I didn't even really realize I was lonely. And so I just withdraw rather than reaching out. So I had to learn to be able to know what I was feeling and then know how to meet those needs. And it's sometimes I still have issues with that because I love to work. And so I can ignore other needs because I could spend my time working and writing and also to be able to really go deep inside and let go and surrender and get out of my head and come to my senses, lose my mind and come to my senses. So be able, I finally, after all these years, figured out what self-love is and what surrender means. And it's about letting go of our ego. You know, they say the ego is edging God out. So that means I just have to quiet my mind. And then amazing things happen. You know, that's where healing comes. But we can't predict it. We can't sometimes really know the right path or the right solution because we can't figure it out with our codependent mind. We have to allow something higher to come in to guide us rather than us control. So giving up control, which is a key symptom of codependency, is really hard for me. It's almost easier with other people. Well, that sometimes is a challenge, but even with myself. So I wrote a blog about, because I was curious about that, the difference between being strong-willed and willful, or self-will. You know, they say we have self-will run riot. So what's the difference between having a strong will and being self-willed? Well, when you're strong-willed, you take in all the information. You're not wedded to and you stand your ground. You're not blind to other possibilities. And you speak your truth. It's not about being headstrong and being stubborn and trying to get your way or controlling other people. It's being responsible for yourself and true to yourself. So I want to share some slides with you that might be helpful. So I'm going to share screen now and open up some slides. Where is it? Here we go. Just a second. Okay, wait a minute. Now I lost Zoom. Just a second. I have to figure out how to do this. Okay, I'm going to share screen. Can you see my screen?
Yes.
Okay. So now I'm going to start the slideshow. Okay. So in my mind, a codependent is someone who can't function from their innate self because we've been so separated from that, from childhood. Actually, it starts in infancy. If a mother doesn't mirror like your needs and your feeling and reflect your feelings, you don't know who you are. And then you start adapting to her. So I wrote a blog about like Paradise Lost. What happened to where's my true self? So it's recovering. I think recovery is recovering that innate self, that true self, that real self, whatever you want to call it. And instead, we start organizing our thinking and behavior around another person, your codependent. And I would say the same applies to substance abusers or process addiction. Underneath that is codependency. And I have a picture here. Can we get this out of the way? Yeah. So a picture of the self. So the real self is in the center. And then we have this, our critic, our shame-based self, covering our real self. And then we have the persona, probably our codependent personality that we show to the world. We're so nice. And we're so willing to help everybody and take care of other people and denying our needs. And then we keep all this resentment inside and try to control them and think that we're going to get love by giving love. And then we have this ideal self. So codependents typically think that that love, giving and loving and is ideal, that they should be selfless and always sacrifice and help others. That's being a good person. And that's usually how they want to strive for. Now you take someone else who is a different personality, they think having power is their ideal. A narcissist, for example, or someone who is just aggressive, they want to be in control and have the power. And that's what they strive for. But and some codependents too, but for mostly your stereotypical codependent, they want to be a giver and a caretaker and deny themselves and a good person, pretty much Christian ideals. And how do I go? Oh. So here you have this weak self that we're not aware of it. So it's weak. I mean, it's not really weak, but because we can't access it, it is. And the critical self around that. And then it leads to all this dysfunctional behavior. We have problems with intimacy because we can't be authentic because we're too afraid. We're ashamed of who we are. We might not know who we are. And then we can't be assertive. So it leads to dysfunctional communication down here because we don't know what we're feeling. We're in denial of our feelings and our needs. And shame leads to that. We hide who we are, even to ourselves and then to other people. And then it leads to control and caretaking. So we feel good about ourselves if we're taking care of someone else. And, you know, there's a payoff in that because we don't have to reveal who we are. And at the same time, we can feel better than them. So we're helping somebody else. So we're in a superior position and we don't have to be vulnerable. We don't have to share ourselves. And there's a bonus because if somebody is needy and they need our help, then they will be dependent on us and then they won't leave us and they won't abandon us. So it takes care of our dependency needs on the other side here. And when we have a weak self, we can't be autonomous. We codependents have difficulty initiating projects and on their own or knowing what to do. So they rather get direction from a teacher or a boss or their partner or a friend, anybody that will tell them what to do or an assignment or something. And then they usually come through, you know, with flying colors, but left to themselves, they go into often a malaise or a depression. And there's a, like a chronic depression underneath, which is a lot of emptiness. Because when you're not in touch with who you are, you just feel like lost. I think of codependency as a disorder of the self, like a lost self that we're trying to recover. And then the feelings, the shame leads to guilt and anxiety and fear, as I said, low self-esteem, and then depression when it really gets bad. And then we're very, our boundaries aren't good because we don't really know who we are. We're very reactive and we have to control somebody else so we'll feel okay. So we want to please them to control them or tell them what to do to control them. And then if then they'll behave in a way to know that we're okay. Because our focus is always on someone else. We spend a lot of time analyzing other people and why they're doing this and what are they feeling and what do they want. And rather than going inside is what am I feeling and what do I need and what do I want? And having the courage to share that, which is assertive. So low self-esteem leads to these feelings of like, I don't trust myself. A lot of indecision is typical. I don't know what to do. I don't want too much attention and not knowing what you want. And a lot of times codependents are in relationships where they feel their feelings are being discounted or they don't feel important or their needs aren't being met. And they think, oh, my partner is so selfish. They just care about themselves. Well, it's probably you need to be more selfish, not so selfless, and speak up because other people are not going to read your mind. You have to ask for what you want. And if they can, why can't you? Other core feelings are anxiety and fear, as I mentioned. It comes from shame, fear about being alone, rejection. And then another fear is like, whoa, if I get too close to somebody, I could lose myself. Just as I said, after my divorce, I became counterdependent because I was afraid I'd go back to being codependent and I'd lose myself. I had just had this beginnings of feeling free and empowered and good about myself. And I was afraid that I'd fall under someone's control again. And feeling of being afraid of getting hurt or some people have a fear of success. for a lot of reasons having to do with their childhood or messages they got. And as I said, that internalized or toxic shame is the core that goes along with this early trauma of emotional abandonment. And some of the feeling people may not identify with the word shame. It's not commonly discussed in Western societies or in Eastern and collectivist cultures. We talk more about guilt, but the codependents have irrational guilt, and that comes from shame because they feel guilty for other people's feelings. Oh, you're in a bad mood. What did I do wrong? So if you're angry, it must be my fault. They're always apologizing. So feelings that go with shame is sometimes feeling like I'm not enough. You always have to do more than your share. You're afraid you're a bad person, or maybe you think people think you're a phony. Some people even hate themselves, or you don't deserve to be happy. You might not know that you have that script going on underneath. Or I've had talked to people that don't feel they got messages that pleasure is bad. So you should never be happy. You could only be unhappy. So these are terrible beliefs that we grow up with. So it sabotages any kind of happiness in your life if you have a lot of these shameful beliefs. And as I said, guilt goes along with that. You're always afraid of making a mistake and that you have to try harder. You have to do more. And feeling responsible for other people, that you're not allowed to make mistakes. And, you know, sometimes people say to me like, oh, I'm going backwards in my program. I had this terrible slip. I didn't do this or I didn't do that. And I just say, well, I'm sure you'll have another opportunity to do it right. So, or do it differently. And that's how we learn, it's from our mistakes. And we have poor boundaries. So I don't know if you could see on my right, maybe it's your left, there's this blurry where this where I begin and you begin or leave off, it's blurry. So it makes codependence very reactive. So we're always reacting to things rather than taking a position. So, and when you have healthy boundaries, you have two whole people that come together and they can disagree and they can then they can negotiate or compromise, but they can take a position. And so now you have, then it allows for real intimacy. Codependents want to be one with someone, but that isn't healthy. That would be like a merger. Actually, that's what you have when you're an infant. And it's maybe wanting to go back to that stage. But by 3 years old, a child is starting to be who they are and learns to separate. And when you don't have healthy parenting before that, you never get that healthy separation. It's called separation individuation. So part of recovery is becoming an individual. That means you have your own thoughts, your feelings, your own perceptions, your own beliefs, your own decisions. And that they're yours. They're not just things that you were told or by your family or church. Or what your partner says. And then of course, dependency is a symptom. So I said, it's hard to do things on your own, afraid of being alone. You don't come from your core of what you wanna do. Instead, you wanna be told what to do, or in this fear of abandonment and being alone is at the bottom, and non-assertive communication. So, codependents can be very manipulative. People-pleasing is manipulative. And they're often judging others, telling them what to do, avoiding I statements. It's like, what do you want to do? No, what do you want to do? Not taking a position. Can't say no. Typically, they ask questions rather than making a statement. The same thing. They don't want to take a position. They don't want to stick your neck out. And a lot of victim talk. Blaming others, making apologies all the time, and not being honest in their being evasive. And the reason is this is a fear of being disliked, being criticized, that the relationship will be ruptured, that there'll be a burden or an imposition to someone, or that someone will retaliate. Often you have a dysfunctional parent or with a personality disorder, you get retaliation if you don't obey. They're afraid of making a mistake or looking foolish. And a lot of times people say, well, I'm afraid of hurting someone's feelings. You know, I think that's what they think, but underneath that is they don't want to hurt someone's feelings because they don't want a rupture in the relationship. So it's really coming from self-interest, that they don't want a conflict or they don't want to be judged or left. So it sounds altruistic that I don't want to hurt their feelings, but it's actually more hurtful not to be direct and honest with someone. And I mentioned, because of the weak boundaries, being very reactive instead of responding, reacting to someone. When you do, it puts someone else in charge of your self-esteem. So now you're going along with their agenda rather than what you want or what you need. And a healthy relationship, you know, it's 50-50, but codependents tend to do more, give more, and are in relationships that are out of balance because they have a warped sense of responsibility. They think, I'm responsible for you and you're responsible for me. Or you made me do this, you're making me feel guilty. The locus of control, the center is always outside of themselves. So actually we're responsible to someone, like if we give our word to be reliable, but we're responsible for ourselves, not for anyone else. And I'm gonna skip ahead because we don't have a lot of time here, but I would say that what recovery looks like, is to be a fully functioning individual who is autonomous and can act on their own. They can be on their own. They're capable of intimacy. That means being close and being honest with someone, being authentic. And that their feelings and their values and needs are aligned with who they say they are. They don't say one thing and do something else or pretend that they aren't, that they're someone other than who they are. So basically they're authentic and that allows for intimacy. And that's the opposite of shame, where you're hiding. So you're revealing yourself and that allows for intimate relationships. And I would say some of the steps of recovery are first coming out of denial. And on my website, I have a new banner and it's all the steps in my mind of recovery. It's like a slideshow. And coming out of denial, letting go of others, so we're not trying to change them and focusing on them, building our self-esteem and healing our past wounds, learning to be assertive and have functional, healthy communication, and that allows us to set boundaries. And then being able to find pleasure and have hobbies and interests. And then we take that out into the world and we feel, I think, like self-esteem, empowerment is self-esteem in action. So we're living who we are. We're expressing who we are and our passions in the world and leading the life that we want to live. So I'll just stop now because I think that's an hour, and I'll pass on something to you that I've learned in that sometimes when I've had to make difficult decisions, I've asked myself, what is the most loving act? And sometimes other emotions come in, like shame, fear, guilt. So I would say to myself, if I didn't have guilt, if I didn't have fear, or shame or anger or any of those, if I was like enlightened, what would I decide? And what would be the most loving decision for myself? So I want to thank you all for listening. And I'm open to any questions that you have now. So I'll just close with that.
Thank you, Darlene.
Thank you. Anyone has any questions, I'm glad to answer them.
Caroline, I have a question. So,
is there a microphone?
It sounded like you had the same mother I had. And I was just wondering if when we have to grow up with a mom like that, like what happens to us? Like, because I know I had some issues, but I was just wondering if you could just expand on that a little.
Right. Well, I think I was trying to explain, like, at least to, in my case, I was lost touch with my feelings and my needs. And I had this core of shame where I didn't feel like I was a good person. And my mother would say I was selfish. Of course, that was her projection. And, or that I was inconsiderate, and all these things. So my needs were considered, I couldn't ask for my needs because that would be considered selfish, right? So at one time, she gave me a gift that was something that was totally about her. It was not anything that I liked or could use. I don't know, it was a piece of jewelry. And it was very gaudy and ostentatious. And so I asked her to come to the store with me to pick out something else that I needed and wanted. And her answer is, oh, why? Why should I do that? You'll just get what you want, which kind of says it all. So if I would do what I want, then that was something that was bad. So my wants, I wasn't supposed to follow through with my wants. So how could I ever be happy, you know, if I didn't do what I wanted? And some people, they did, some developmental therapists work with, start from infancy, and they'll throw a toy or a shiny object on the floor, and they'll ask the patient, like, well, they'll just see what, you know, are they interested in that? And sometimes the patient will just lay there and not do anything. So other times they'll go look at it, and then they kind of get deflated in a depression. So there are different levels of wounding depending on the mothering. So of course, sometimes there's mothers that are totally neglectful and not even there, or saying, I'm sorry you were born. And just like really, or you're just don't show any interest in the child. My mother didn't do that. She was over-involved. So she was very controlling and invasive. So you could have narcissistic parents could go either way, either neglectful or over-involved. And so if they're over-involved, it might make you afraid to get too close to someone that they're going to start to control you. So if they're neglectful, then you might be more of a pursuer in a relationship. So, but basically it's just not feeling good about yourself. And you'd have to look at all the ways where that comes up in your life, not feeling that you're enough. Or I always tell people, write down your negative self-talk. It's very illuminating. And often it goes back to a critical parent, mother or a father's voice, sometimes a sibling. And we internalize that voice in our head. So our parent doesn't even have to be around, and we're still having that inner conflict. We're still putting ourselves down. And until that changes, well, that's what we'll attract. We have to start being gentle with ourselves and forgiving of ourselves and tender with ourselves. And it can be hard when you didn't have nurturing. It's been hard for me to learn that because I didn't have that. I used to wish that my mother baked cookies, like some of my friends' mothers, or that she was a PTA representative or a brownie mother. And I didn't really know what nurturing was or exactly how to describe what I was missing. But I thought maybe she baked cookies. She'd be like those other mothers that I wanted. And so I really didn't know what nurturing was. And we end up treating ourselves the way we were treated. So especially women, because we're in the womb with our mother and we're so close to our mothers, boys have to separate to become men. So women tend to treat themselves the way their mothers treated them. And so learning to be nurturing to ourselves has been a journey for me. That's one of the skills I think that we have to learn to have higher self-esteem, learn to be assertive, and assertiveness builds self-esteem, and self-esteem reflects our assertiveness. It kind of goes together, and learning how to nurture ourselves. So those are some of the things that the repair of that mother wound. I don't know if that was what you were looking for.
It was. Thank you very, very much. That was amazing. Let me see if anybody else has a question. Does anybody else have a question or can I ask Darwin anything? Kelly wants to know if she can see the slide that you had that said top dog on top of it.
Yeah, I'll tell a story about it. Okay, so this picture is in Codependency for Dummies. And often in relationships that are out of balance, there's a top dog and an underdog. I call it underdog and top dog. And sometimes they change places. So in this case, I'm thinking of the top dog as a person who feels superior. And it might be a codependent caretaker. So I'm going to help this person who's an underdog, who's needy or depressed or has an addiction or needs money or whatever it is. And I'm going to be the rescuer and I'm going to be help them. And I call it a seesaw of codependency. So the top dog thinks I'm responsible for the underdog. And the underdog feels like I can't take care of myself. I need somebody's help. So they can't stand on their own. And actually the top dog often can't stand on their own either. Sometimes they need somebody to need them. And so this was somewhat, I described a little bit in my marriage, the Cartman triangle, where I was helping my husband, who as I saw as the underdog, and then we'd switch places, and then he would go on the attack. But a lot of times, when you're so focused on helping someone and the relationship ends, it's like you're out of a job, so you don't feel needed, or the person gets better, and then they don't need you to be doing all this stuff for them. Particularly my experience was with an addict. And so, you know, if you don't feel good about yourself, you don't have anything else going on for you, then your low self-esteem starts to reveal itself. So the underdog feels like vulnerable, and they're kind of self-centered about their problems. And they feel they're irresponsible often. They feel like they need help. They feel guilty sometimes asking for help. And they think it's all your fault and feel sorry for themselves like a victim. And they feel unworthy. But they feel love when they're receiving. So like a narcissist, they feel they want to be loved and admired. And that makes them feel good for a little while. Of course, it's never ending with a narcissist. But then the top dog feels like they're invulnerable and they're focused on someone else. They feel self-sufficient, even if they're not. They feel like, I'm fine. A lot of times they're in denial of their need for love, because if it's been shamed, as I mentioned earlier, then they're not even realize that they need love until they're in a relationship when they might lose it. And then they, I'm not so self-sufficient. So this would be typical of a narcissist too, who acts like they're self-sufficient. They have a lot of shame around their vulnerability and need for love or affection, dependency needs. But if you threaten to leave, then they'll suddenly, you know, decide they're going to turn over a leaf and they're going to do what you want, maybe go to therapy or something. That's usually short-lived. But the top dog is over-responsible, whereas the underdog is irresponsible. But they feel loved being needed. So if someone needs me, then I guess I have something to give them, then I'm lovable. And they feel guilty if they're not helping. So to not help somebody, they feel like I'm a bad person. They also feel like poor me. You know, I'm unhappy and it's all your fault, and they blame underdog. So both feel unworthy underneath. So they're just kind of mirrors of each other, but the behavior is different. Any other questions? Annie?
Darlene, thank you.
Unmute yourself.
That was beautiful. Thank you so much.
Yes, I have a question.
Sure, Annie.
Okay. So how did you recover from shame?
Aha. Okay. Good question. Well, actually, I went into psychoanalysis and my therapist would challenge some of my beliefs or feelings, like, oh, I couldn't say that, or, you know, I shouldn't want that or do that. And she'd say, well, why not? And little by little, you know, I started being able to feel that it was okay to be myself and taking risks of being myself. So I remember, and by the way, you know, shame is a feeling. So we don't stop ever feeling shame, just like anger or sadness or joy or love. But we don't want it to control us. So taking risks is, and exposing yourself to be authentic, to say, speak your truth. And I remember I was talking, I went out to dinner with a girlfriend, and I had just heard from some man I was dating that he was gonna break up or something. And I was telling her, and I was going on and on about this and how upset I was. And then she said to me, Darlene, she said, you haven't even asked anything about me. You've just been talking about yourself. And I know, like some years earlier, I would have been mortified. I would have felt so ashamed that I wasn't being nice or good, that I was being self-centered. But instead I just said, oh, You're right. So I was just upset about so-and-so. So tell me how you've been. You know, I was able to switch. So I wasn't overwhelmed with shame. And shame is very, very visceral. It's a sympathetic nervous system response. So it's it takes over you, where you want to withdraw, you want to hide. So the first step is really being able to identify it. And I would say, when you start to have those feelings of panicky, or you want to hide, or you feel like a bad person, or foolish, any of those kinds of feelings, that you may not be able to do it in the moment, but afterwards, like write down all of your thoughts, your feelings, your physical sensations, and then what associations do you have to your past? And so making the link often to what's happening in the present, to what happened in the past, can help you be overcome like toxic shame. Because toxic, regular shame, just, it comes and goes. But with toxic shame, it leads to the shame anxiety. We're always afraid of experiencing shame, like if we make a mistake or if we look foolish, or we're going to be judged, and that it could be unconscious. We don't even know that we have it. And it can take over our whole personality. So just becoming more aware of it. And I, as I said, write down all your negative self-talk and start to be aware when you're shaming yourself. A lot of times people come to me and they'll say, you know, I've been in a funk. I've just had no energy. And I don't know, it's kind of down. And then I said, when did it start? And then we track back to what was going on. And maybe, you know, it could be a minor thing. Someone said something at work, or somebody didn't call them back, you know, or maybe they're on a diet and they overate and then they shame themselves for that. It could be something they said to themselves. So that's the other thing. It doesn't have to be an exposure in front of someone else. It could happen in your own mind that you, you know, you don't fit into a dress you used to wear or something. You put on weight. So, but just, you know, the antidote to shame is sharing and being who we are, being authentic. So take those risks where it's safe to do and practice that. Be aware when you, I also suggest to people that at the end of the day, if you have any challenging conversations or with your partner, write out what happened. And then ask yourself, did my words match my feelings and my thoughts? Was I authentic? Or was I hiding who I was? And if not, why not? What was I afraid of? And how would I have handled it differently? What could I have said that would have been truthful? And then taking those risks. And, you know, it's not going to be perfect. And a clue is actually, if I'm having resentment towards someone, it probably means I need to speak up. So if I'm complaining to someone else or a friend about someone, then maybe I need to speak up. What am I afraid of? Why don't I take that risk? And, you know, for a long time, because of the relations, those significant relations with my mother, with my husband, I thought like, and I've heard people say this, well, why bother? Because they're not going to change. Well, it's important for us to speak up, regardless of whether they change or not. This is important for us too. And then I've discovered, there are people that are willing to accommodate you and make changes. That was a revelation to me. Not everybody is my way or the highway.
Okay, well, anybody else? Well, sure did love it. You're amazing. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for inviting me. Enjoy the rest of the weekend.
Thank you. It was great. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye, darling.
Thanks.